What number is this, Chip?
Episode 20, Monkey's Mailbag and an Interview with Val Caries.
Okay, no, I mean, like, don't get excited, man. It's because I'm short, I know. Zilch.
You're listening to Zilch, a Monkey's podcast.
And with that music, you know you are listening to Your Monkeys Podcast, Zilch. And I am joined by Sarah Clark.
Hey.
And the wonderful Craig Cohen.
Oh, thank you, Ken. It truly makes me feel wonderful to hear you say that.
Today on Zilch, we have an interview with someone who was there pretty much right from the beginning. She was on the TV show and she worked with the guys back behind the scenes. And she has her really cool stories to tell. And who is this, Sarah?
Rob Roy Fingerhead?
Yes, Rob Roy. No, no. Val Caries joins us today. And and you've seen her on The Monkey Show. If you ever watched it, she had several appearances over the years. And actually, there's even a bit part she's in head if you look for her. So this is going to be lots of fun. And Melanie Mitchell, author of
Monkey Magic.
Monkey Magic. And she will be joining us and doing that interview, and it's going to be really cool. Recently, Craig, Jeff, and Melanie all went to the Peter Tork show.
I myself am deeply jealous.
The Peter Tork Facebook page put us on their page, and that was pretty cool, wasn't it, Craig?
Yeah, that was pretty amazing. So Jeff was the first one to go up to Peter, and I guess he mentioned to Peter that we did a podcast called Zilch, and Peter didn't seem incredibly aware of us, but the woman at his merch table instantly perked up, and when Jeff got up, she said, oh, you guys are from the Zilch podcast, and she proceeded to really talk the show up to the point that it was a show I was like, man, I want to listen to this show. But no, but I mean, she had so many great words for the show, and she loved the level of respect that we've shown it. Just really thought it was something special, and she compared it to that popular fanzine, I guess, from the 80s.
Monkey Business Fanzine by Maggie McManus.
Absolutely.
That's the one.
I want to be Maggie when I grow up.
You're on your way.
It was really, really great to hear that folks from Peter's team, who have been great with us on Facebook to begin with, you know, were able to vocalize, you know, their feelings toward the show and how special they think it is.
That is so cool. Hopefully in our next episode, we'll give a full review of the... I'm going to get this wrong. Shoe Suede Blues. Did I do it? Did I get it?
You did it.
Oh, wow. But now I can't say blue suede shoes. So anyway, we hope to give a full review of the Shoe Suede Blues concert and talk about that night on our next episode. So we look forward to that. But we want to thank everybody that runs the Peter Tork official Facebook page, and we just appreciate you. Thank you. Well, let's dive into the Monkey's Mailbag.
P.O. Box 9847.
This one's going to be kind of a fun one because we're going to actually hear some of our listeners' voices, and we're also going to look at some people that are catching up with the show because we're on like episode 20. People are like just discovering the show, so that's kind of cool, right?
Totally.
Well, let's take our first one. And, of course, some people leave us reviews on iTunes, and this is one from our iTunes feedback. If you want to leave a review, it helps people know about the show. So, Sarah, why don't you take this feedback?
Sure. This one's titled Never Knew of Remember by Slick Tumic. He gave us a 5-star rating. Yay. And he says, I assume Slick's a he, says, thanks for the review of Remember. I have to get it now. Yay, more money for Mickey. I watched all the shows when they first aired, and all I can really remember are the Yardley commercials.
And that was, of course, a 5-star review, so we want to thank you for doing that.
Yay!
So, very cool, very cool. Our next email is from Nathan Cooper. Just started listening to the Zilch podcast over the last week. I deliver mail on a walking route, and so I have a lot of time to listen. I just finished episode 5 of Zilch. See, people are catching up. Keep up the great work. I'm a huge Monkey fan who came into them during the 80s Nickelodeon run. I recorded all of them onto VHS at the time, except for 2 episodes that I never got. The Spy Who Came In From the Cool and Monkey Mare. I look forward to catching up with all the podcasts. Well, we're glad you're listening. And our next color commentary, isn't that going to be The Spy Who Came from the Cool, Craig?
Yes, it is. That is our next scheduled commentary track.
Excellent. Fantastic. And Craig, I'm going to have you read this one because it's much longer than mine was.
Thank you. This is from Ariel Welly, and she says, I am just now listening to the sixth episode of the podcast, and in all honesty, I was not really as into it in the beginning as I had been with the other episodes. Hear me out, though, because this was merely for the fact that I have never been to a monkeys convention. Actually, I've only been to one convention in my life, so I was not relating to it too much. Yet what really grasped me into this section of the show was the intensity of Jodi Ritson's love for and anecdotes about her experience with the monkeys. I found myself giggling and having even more fun in one almost full hour sequence than I had in some of the other episodes put together, even though I do enjoy them all 1,000%. This one just exceeded my expectations for no reason other than the fact that I was reeled in so deep that I thought 5 minutes had passed by the time the segment was over, although in reality it was 50. Everything about this show is wondrously executed, and I've been finding myself eagerly pressing play on the next episode as one is over. I'm sad I pushed off catching up with Zilch as long as I did. Very, very well done. I am impatiently waiting for the next Monkeys convention now. Thanks for a great show, and huge shout out to Mrs. Ritson, who has been my favorite guest so far, although no one compares with Ken Mills and the gang.
Ken and the gang. I think we're going to start a band.
Yeah.
We'll do Celebrate. What do you think? Our next listener feedback. Now, this one's going to be kind of unusual. We recently did Headquarters. We did Side 1 and Side 2, two separate episodes. And we put out a call and we told our listeners, if you send us an MP3, we may play it on the show. So here's some feedback from Jeff Geringer on Headquarters.
Hey guys, thank you for the opportunity. This is Jeff Geringer, first generation fan out of Southern California. While I appreciate Headquarters for its creativeness and the need for the guys to express their artistic desires, it's never been one of my favorite albums. For every Shades of Grey and Randy Scouse Get the Shine, then there's also a You Told Me and Sunny Girlfriend that sounds uneven and almost unprofessional from a garage band standpoint. I've often wondered if the Monkees had not become adversarial with Don Kirshner, if on the fourth and fifth album, by using Kirshner's ear and his amazing group of songwriters from the Brill Building, where the Monkees would have ended up on the hit parade. I think their finest single is Pleasant Valley Sunday. And while Kirshner was long out of the picture, they used the Kirshner Brill Building songwriting team of Jerry Goffin and Carole King. There's obviously more songs like that the Monkees could have recorded, and I think time would have eased a little bit. Maybe Nesmith wouldn't have been so angry at Kirshner, and there could have been a meeting of the minds and even ground where they could have had the flip side of their next single, or they could have had more tracks on the fourth album. And thanks for having this discussion. I have to say, this has been the best podcast ever. Hearing you guys go back and forth on Sunny Girlfriend was so entertaining. I'm screaming at my iPod wanting to get in on the argument. So you guys rock. Thanks.
So that was pretty cool. It's kind of nice hearing these these audio mailbag, if you will. This is pretty cool. This is very cool. And here's another one from the lovely Paula Brinkman. Now, this one, she kind of is replying to Ghosty Timmer's take on what would have happened had the Monkees never recorded Headquarters. That was pretty cool, right, guys?
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite things we've had on the show to date.
Ghosty's just amazing.
Yeah.
Let's check out the lovely Paula Brinkman's take on what Ghosty had to say.
I'm sitting in my car after just hearing Ghosty Timmer's version of What If There Had Never Been a Headquarters. I found myself shocked, amazed, screaming at the car radio as it was playing. And all I could think was, it just would have never been the same ever. Without Headquarters, the Monkees were just a pop band under the thumb of Kirshner. With this was their declaration of independence. They had the opportunity. They didn't even have the opportunity. They made the opportunity happen. They fought for this opportunity. As tired and exhausting of a schedule that they worked, by God, they were going to make this happen. And after this, they had legitimacy. without a doubt, nobody could say they were just a band. They were a TV show, they were a band, they were an act, they were a concert touring machine. And 45 years later, we're still celebrating them. Without Headquarters, we don't get Shorty Blackwell. Without Headquarters, we don't get Head. Oh my God, can you imagine such a concept? Without Headquarters, we don't get Porpoise Song, Circle Sky, and As We Go Along. Headquarters started the real Monkees, in my mind.
These are a lot of fun. I hope more people send these in.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to that. So you can send them to us, care of zilchmonkees, one word, at gmail.com. zilchmonkees@gmail.com. Of course, we all love that song. We are continuing the episode with Melanie Mitchell.
Hi, Ken.
Melanie, please tell us who's on the other end of the Zilch line.
Oh, I am just so excited that we have Valerie Carey's Vinay with us today. Hi, Valerie.
Hi, Melanie. Hi, Ken.
Hi. We're so glad to have you here. We've been wanting you on the show, and you and the Monkees have quite a history with one another. We were discussing the song that folks just heard in the intro, Valerie. Tell us about how you are associated with that song, other than sharing a name.
It's really a kind of an interesting story, because when we were doing the show, when we were shooting the show, I knew the song came out, but I never thought that it was about me.
Mm-hmm.
I think Peter mentioned to me, well, we couldn't help but think about you, Valerie, when we were recording it, and that was very sweet. But I never, ever had an inkling that it was about me, you know. About 3 or 4 years ago, there was a showing of 4 episodes of the Monkees at the Egyptian Theater on Hollywood Boulevard.
Oh, wow.
I was invited to come there, and there was going to be a Q&A afterwards. So I went at the Q&A. That question came up, was the song Valerie written about you? And I said, oh, my goodness, I said, you know, I said, I don't know, but I said, I get that question all the time. I said, but we're sitting right next to me is Bobby Hart, and he wrote the song. So wow. I handed him the microphone. What a lucky break, right?
Yeah.
And I thought he'd tell the story about Valerie and how it was written and what, you know, how it came up and everything. He picked up the mic and he looked directly at me and he said, of course it was. And I just about fell off my stool. You know, we were sitting on these high stools. And I just about fell over because it was pretty shocking to me, you know. And at the same time, I was so delighted, of course, you can well imagine. And so there's how I found out that it was.
Wow.
And I would say that it, I would still say that it wasn't written about me, per se. I would say that maybe I inspired it. Because I later read that, what was the person's name that was in charge of all
Kirshner?
The music?
Don
right.
Kirshner.
He actually, when the Monkees became really big, that he actually said to boys, give me girls' names, give me songs with girls' names.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wrote the song, probably because they saw me on the set all the time. I was there so often. That's my guess. I found out that Bobby did, in fact, have a girlfriend in high school, and her name was Valerie, and he went steady with her. He pinned her.
Plus, Valerie sounds a lot better when you're singing it than, like, Zelda.
Or Griselda.
Or Nancy.
Well... Is there a song, Auntie Griselda?
Yes,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that you've been involved in all sorts of things and you've witnessed all the different levels of the entertainment industry. A lot of people may or may not know it, But you were also married to Nick Vinay. He and his brother Steven Vinay helped shape popular music and popular culture in some ways. Your husband, Nick Vinay, he worked with such notables as Chet Baker, Nat King Cole, Stan Getz, Peggy Lee, Ravi Shankar, The Letterman, and as well as being a producer, he was the head of A&R at Capitol. He is primarily known for signing the Beach Boys and producing their early material. He also produced and recorded a number of important Capitol clients like Glenn Campbell, Jim Croce, Bobby Darin, the Kingston Trio, The Letterman, Ricky Nelson, Lou Rawls, Sam Cooke, Linda Ronstadt, John Stewart, Don McLean, Bobby Womack, Frank Zappa, and many others. And he's also responsible for one of my favorite albums, Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks' 2,000-Year-Old Man series. And not many people can say that they worked with Orson Welles, so that's like a staggering amount of culture and pop culture that he was part of. That's amazing.
It really is, and I'm so glad that you brought it up. It, you know, it's easier to say what didn't Nick do than what did he do, because just about everything that you hear, he had something to do with it.
Absolutely.
And that's really true.
And he also has that monkey connection, because he also helped produce Linda Ronstadt's track, Different Drum, which was written.
He didn't help produce it. He produced it.
Yes, yes.
And he made her do the upbeat version of it. But, you know, the way Michael wrote it is, and the way Michael sings it is different than the way Linda did it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Nick's idea. And I don't think Linda liked it at first. That's what I've read. And it was a surprise for her in the studio, from what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, I'm so glad that you did bring up his name, because he deserves a lot of recognition. And I don't think that he has recognition from a lot of people. I think that in the music industry, certainly he's well known.
Right, absolutely. And his brother, Steve, he wrote Action for Paul Revere and the Raiders and Freddie Cannon. Freddie Boom Boom Cannon. That's an amazing song. And to have a Monkees connection, you know, along with all of his other works, he also wrote Tomorrow's Gonna Be Another Day.
Yes, he's very, very talented. They say that the whole family is really talented.
Mm-hmm. How did you become an actress? Where did that all start?
When I was just about 16 years old, I took a part-time job downtown Los Angeles for opticians. They sold eyeglasses, you know. I was at the front desk for a couple of hours modeling their eyeglasses, welcoming in the patients or the clients. One of the opticians had a friend of his come in, and his name was Michael McLean. Michael McLean came up to the desk, said, "Have you ever thought about being in the movies?" And I, of course, went, "Well, yes, of course." I started dating him. He was, you know, we were young. And it turned out that his father was the head of talent at 20th Century Fox for more than 30 years, right under Zanuck. Later on, Michael became a casting director at 20th Century Fox, and he did movies like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, A Great White Hope, The Sound of Music.
Wow.
And I must say that he is the one that gave me my whole start, he and his father, and helped me a lot. It was a great big break.
Wow, that's just like a classic Hollywood legend you discovered at the optician's office.
Yes, isn't it? It really is. I love you, Melanie.
Oh, you're very
she laughs at young. Everything I say. I love that.
So what was your job on the Monkees, and how did you get that gig?
I started out in the movie industry at first working background. I think my very, very first job was on the Hank Williams story, and it was a huge crowd scene, and that was, I think, 1964.
Mm.
And here it was my first job, and I was a nervous wreck, you know. Michael and his father started me in on standing in for people, because that was a real good way to learn how to be around the camera, get familiar with it and everything. They thought that that would be a real good way to start me off. It was. I started standing in for people, and I stood in for Elizabeth Montgomery on the Columbia lot on Bewitched. I stood in for Barbara Eden. You get to know people, and they request you because, you know, if you're good and you stick to the camera and you do your job correctly, you're in demand. I also worked on a lot of Jerry Lewis films, and I was on the lot a lot. I got this call saying that there would be an interview. We called them interviews on stage four, and it was so strange because I've never been on an interview like this. Stage was dark. There may have been like one little light on the stage, which was unusual. There was no one there, and I thought, gee, you know, what's this about? And then I heard footsteps, like a scary movie, you know? Uh-huh. It turned out to be Bert Schneider. You know, he introduced himself. I introduced myself. He asked me if I could travel. I said yes. And he asked me if I would mind standing in for a young man. And I said, no, of course not. And didn't matter to me. I was interested in keeping my rent paid. So a job is a job, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be Davy Jones. So that's how I got the job on the Monkees. You know, everybody on the Monkees set, they were such nice people. But on the pilot, I was not in the pilot.
Right.
I stood in for the, I forget the actress's name now that was in the pilot that was Davy's.
Love interest or wannabe love interest.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I stood in for her. And we went to Del Coronado Island in San Diego, and, you know, we had a lot of fun. And, you know, they brought in a lot of people, a lot of, but you don't see me in the pilot.
But you were on the set. Were you standing in for Davy for the pilot?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And then when the show got going, there was a person by the name of David Price, who is a dear friend of mine.
Uh-huh.
And he was a friend of Michael Nesmith. I think they went to school together. I think they went to high school together. And he took the job of standing in for Davy. But of course, the crew still liked me because I was more Davy size and everything. So we kind of shared that on the QT, you know.
Uh-huh.
And there was some talk about that the union didn't really approve that, you know, men had to stand in for men and women had to stand in for women. So, you know, there was that too. Sometimes they'd squish David down.
Yes.
I just had lunch with David, and he said, they used to squish me down. And I said, but I was hired for being stand-in. And he went, well, I was his stand-in. Really, I was, Valerie. I said, yes, I know. You know, confusion.
Well, he was much taller than you were.
He was. He's like over 6 feet tall.
Uh-huh. So when he had to stand up for Davy, he had to scrunch all up, but... You were
and he
more
was more of
fit.
A, oh, he did, David, though, he has such a great sense of humor. We laughed and I had a good time. That the Monkees show was so dear to me, so much fun to work on.
Now, there were other stand-ins. Do you remember any of their names?
Rick Quine,
mm-hmm.
Who is no longer with us. Was John London one of the stand-ins?
I believe so.
Yeah, I think so, too. What a sweetie pie.
And there was another David Pearl.
David Pearl, uh-huh.
So the five of you were kind of like a team, correct?
We were, yeah. We were all a team. Really, good memories.
Tell me about the people who are running the show. The producers, Bob Rafelson, Bert Schneider, and also director James Frawley.
James Frawley, yes. Oh, my God, what a great bunch of guys.
Wow.
I can't say enough about the people. They're wonderful, such good people. You know, from the get-go, from the pilot on, I became very, very attached to what was going on with the Monkee Show.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd stop in when I was on the lot, and so I would stop in and run into the Raybird offices and say, did it sell? We don't know yet. And then one day I walked in and I looked at Bob Rafelson, and he had the long face.
Oh.
And he looked at me and he said, nope, didn't sell, we didn't get picked up. I was in such a state of shock when he said that. I didn't believe it. And I said, it will. And I turned around and I left. Uh-huh. And then it did. And so the next time I came in, after it was, he said, Valerie, he said, you're our good luck charm. So... Bert was a very special person, and honest to God, I think that we were like this big family on that set, with everybody, the makeup people, the wardrobe people, everybody, every single person, the lighting, the whole crew, the whole cast. It was really a wonderful place to be.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Frawley. Mm-hmm. I remember one incident with James Frawley that was so funny. I came in, you get to know how to come in and out of off the sound stage.
Uh-huh.
The light is blinking, that means they're rolling, don't go in, you know, don't open the door. But I knew how to do that, I knew how to sneak in, right? So the light is blinking, so I go in quietly through the door, and now I'm tiptoeing. And I'm tiptoeing and walking very closely so that my feet don't make a sound. All of a sudden I hear, cut! And James Frawley, the whole crew is just cracking up, says, Val, you just walked through the shot. And I didn't realize it, but I was walking by one of those fake windows,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so they were shooting, and they could see that window. And here I came tiptoeing very, very quietly.
My God, you were quiet!
Yeah, very quietly. Yeah, very quietly. I didn't realize that I was in the shot, so... That was so funny. But he was always fantastic, fantastic director and wonderful person and unbelievable. Bert, he hired me. What can I say? He's the one that, you know, hired me and put me on the show. I remember one day, yeah, Ward Sylvester. He walked up to me one day and he said, Valerie, we're writing something for you. And I thought, what are you talking about? I was like, what is he talking about? And it was the Kidnappers.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and they put me, actually, in a different union, Screen Actors Guild.
Wow.
Now, did your rate mm-hmm. of pay go up then, too? Because you went from being...
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, a lot.
Wow.
It was a great big difference in those days.
Wow. Yeah,
I think it's...
So when you got that speaking role, the check went through the roof there for you. That was pretty good.
And residuals.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we want to play that line right now for you, okay?
Oh, good.
All right. Here we go.
Okay.
Hey, where are you two going?
I'm going home to get kidnapped.
Well, I want to come too.
Okay.
Come on, everybody. Party at Baby's Place.
And then there's the boys. They're all tied up, and Davey and everybody's going to come through the door. So.
Oh, that's so sweet. And I had one of my fans tell me that they were so worried that when I had the rope around my neck. They took it literally. You know, they don't know that it's just very loosely draped.
So that was a fun scene, and there you got to work with Vic Tay back there. There was always a really good mix of people coming through the Monkees set, and a lot of people may not realize it, but you were also on many other shows. You were on 12 O'Clock High, and you were on one of my favorite shows of all time, which I'll be getting the Blu-ray of soon, and that is Batman.
Right. That'll be great.
Can't wait to get it. It's probably going to be my Christmas gift, so you're going to be part of my Christmas gift.
Mm.
Now, was that a fun set to work on, the Batman TV show? Yeah, meow. Was the Batman TV show fun to work on as well?
It was. It was. It was a lot of fun.
Do you have any memories from that real quick?
I do. Julie, she was such a riot.
Mm-hmm.
She's one of my idols. You've got to know that she is definitely one of my idols, and I looked up to her so much. But I was in my dressing room, and all of a sudden I hear the director just screaming and yelling and furious,
mm-hmm.
you know, and screaming that he's tired of actresses this and that, and I'm going, oh my God, oh my God. I mean, I was scared to death. And so I peek out of my dressing room, and there's Julie up on the catwalks. And have you ever been on a soundstage? They're huge.
Right.
And way up high. Julie had climbed the ladders, and they call them the catwalks, where they have lights and stuff that can, down below. And there she was in her cat stance, swatting at the director like he was a mouse, and hissing, and wow, you know. He was screaming, get down from there. You know, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars in those days of money going down the drain.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just furious. And she finally came down and everything. But I was shaking. I was like the most nervous kitten that you've ever seen in your life. I was just shaking from it all because I thought the director was definitely mad at me, too. And I was not as familiar as on the monkey set. I was used to the monkey set on a daily basis. It was just like every day, whereas this was only a couple of episodes, you know. Sandman cometh.
Yes.
And Catwoman goeth.
Mm-hmm.
So
you played the part of one of Catwoman's hench people.
Hench kitten,
that's what it is. Yeah, that's right. That's what she says. Yeah, a hench kitten.
Hench kitten.
Wow.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Now, when you first met the boys, were you taken by them as people that you could work with? Was it an enjoyable set?
They were great guys. They're, you know, each and every one of them, they're unique in their own ways, and they're wonderful. I can't even find the words to describe them. They're so dear to me, and I recall those days. They were all so good to me. I'm so fortunate to have met them.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Mike Nesmith, and on my left is the delightful and charming personality, David Jones.
Thank you, Mike.
No sweat.
And on my left is the charming and delightful Peter Tork.
Thank you, David. And on my charming and delightful is the left moderator, Nikki Dolenz.
Now, was it strange seeing them go from, because you were there at the beginning with the pilot, and the next thing you know, the show is not only a go, but it's a hit. And now you're seeing monkey mania happen. You're seeing them explode into teen magazines and stuff like that. So did it go from like being a quiet set to people trying to get involved more, or what was that like, seeing all that happen?
All I remember is that from the time we started shooting, people wanted to be on that set. I would equate it to like the Friends set. Everybody wanted to be on it. Everybody wanted to be a guest star. Everybody wanted to hang out on the set, even if they weren't an actor. We had all of these musicians that would stop by. You know, Jack Nicholson was always on the set. And Dennis Hopper was always on the set. It was fun. The guys were fun. I, you know, when I was working on the show, I had no idea because we were working.
Right.
We didn't have iPhones. We didn't have DVRs to play back something. We had only, you know, Channel 2, Channel 4, Channel 5, Channel 7, 9, 11, and 13.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all we had. And we didn't have, say, video playback. The only person that had that was Jerry Lewis in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know the outside world because, you get to the set at, you know, 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, sometimes 5 o'clock in the morning, and then you don't get home until 9 or 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing that you can do is go to sleep and hope to wake up, you know, real early, and this was 5 days a week. I don't know how the boys did it because they were touring with the music thing too. I really don't know because I remember just being exhausted. And I know that Davey was often found underneath something on the stage, taking a nap, hiding. Mm-hmm. And because he was so exhausted, they were very, very exhausted. Of course, David Price can tell you a lot about that because he was really kind of like a road manager for them on the music end of it too. So
we look forward to hopefully talking to him.
You can tell him I suggested it.
Okay, definitely.
Okay. I had no idea that there were even pictures of me in Teen Beat or Teen magazines until recently.
Wow.
I had no clue that there were fans that knew who I was.
Right.
Until Facebook.
Oh, spotting you in an episode is a little bit of a sport for us fans. Valerie, I'd like to ask a question about another one of your appearances on the show in a speaking role. And that is the guest starring role you had in the fashion magazine episode, Monkeys a la Mode. Tell us a little bit about that role and how it was being, you know, such a star in an episode.
It was no different than anything else.
Oh, yeah?
Well, because I was so used to being there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was so used to being there, it wasn't like I was thinking that I was going to be a guest star.
Right.
I was even shocked when I found out that I was a guest star.
And this time you had a name.
And delighted, I must say, delighted too. Gee, you know, and now that I look back on it, I'm so grateful for all the opportunities. But, you know, any time they needed me for anything, I was there.
Toby Willis was such a juicy role, especially the way the episode ended with her as the boss character getting really sort of snarky with the monkeys. I loved that scene.
That's the director. The director tells you what he wants. You do the best you can to do it. So, you know,
you nailed
I have
it.
To give credit to our wonderful director there.
Well, what we need is something fresh, new.
Madam Q, I met a group of boys last week that were all that and more.
It says we've been chosen as the typical young Americans of the year.
Hey, we don't subscribe to Sheet Magazine, do we?
No, I'm hip. So Fashion Magazine says here, necklines are plunging lower every year. This year, the V will go down to the tummy and something of a peekaboo effect into the swing of fashions and have your own naval observatory.
You must be joking.
You're right, I am. It doesn't say that at all.
Yeah, come on. Hey, listen to this. Why not take little metal bottle tops and nail them to your living room floor? It gives you the impression that you are walking upon little metal bottle tops. I don't like that typical young person stuff.
This letter says that the Reiner photographer should be here any minute.
Hark! I hear a knock upon yon door. Oh, hello. Why don't you, come in?
Hi, I'm Mickey Doe. Well,
they won't do.
Wait. What? Do? Do what?
Do. Do.
If I beg to differ with you, Madam Quagmire wrote us a letter and said we would do. I'm not sure what kind of do, but we'll do something.
I'm Rob Roy Fingerhead, the chief staff photographer. This is Toby Willis. She'll write the story.
You see, what we want to do is show what you are and the way you live.
What? You want to get us arrested? Don't do that.
No.
Well, young people just aren't typical anything.
Look, fellas, you don't understand the magazine business. Rob Roy isn't such a creep. And think of what that creep could do for your careers. You know, Madam Q expects you at her office tomorrow at 9. Fellas, please trust me.
We'll be there.
Okay.
Hello? Hello? Say, listen, we understood you had a new editor. We thought we'd come see about getting maybe a retraction or something.
Retraction my foot.
Toby, are you the new editor?
And why not? What's so surprising about that?
Well, you know, it's a very responsible job.
Well, I've got some of the best assistants in the business. Right?
Right, Mrs. Willis.
The shoe's on the other foot, so to speak.
Well, I got you there, didn't I?
Hi, this is Coco Dolans, and you're listening to Zilch, a Monkeys podcast.
Did you have any directors that you like to work with over others, like some directors that maybe stand out to you?
Well, you know, of course, James Frawley, because I seem to know him better than the other ones. And I wasn't there the day that Mickey directed. I wish I would have been there. but I don't know what I was doing or where I was. But you know, when The Boys directed, I wish I could have seen that.
Yeah.
I'm proud to say that I now have antenna TV.
Oh, there you go.
So tomorrow will be my first, and I don't even know what time it's on, but the first time that I get to see the Monkees on TV. So I'll be able to be sure about what I'm talking about.
You know, you mentioned that you're finally going to get to see them on TV proper. It's kind of strange that, you know, people think that, like, you work a 9-to-5 job, but that's not what you guys did, and especially The Boys and the Monkees never saw that kind of schedule, because what people may or may not realize is that it wasn't just filming a TV show. It wasn't just practicing to go on the road. It wasn't just going on the road, but it was also recording interviews and traveling all at the same time. In the span of those two and a half years that the show was on, you know, if you count the movie and the special, they put in probably 6 years worth of work in a very short amount of time. So when you say that you never actually got to see the show at the time, that people don't realize the hectic pace that you were on. Was it difficult to be on the set sometime and like kind of observe that, or did it just get to be a natural thing after a while?
Well, luckily, we were young. I don't think I could do it now. But even now, it's kind of grueling when you're working. First of all, I don't think that a lot of people understand how difficult it is to be an actor.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of energy, and then the hours, and certain things have to be done at a certain time, a certain light, it's quite demanding. It's demanding, and it's hard, and it's, what can I say, it's very, very worth it.
You tell me that you've never been this way. You tell me things I know that I've heard somewhere. You're standing in the places and you're staring down faces that bring to mind traces of a girl that I know somewhere. I just can't put my finger on what it is that says to me, watch out, don't believe.
Well, we've noticed a strong shift in the style between the show's early episodes and those filmed in the later season 2. how was the atmosphere on the set or the mechanics of filming? How did that change over time? And we also want to ask you about the big black box. When did the big black box appear that the boys would go into?
Oh, that. I don't remember when it came about, but I remember it being there, and it was just a good place to go hide. Everyone had a dressing room on stage, a little makeshift, like a little house, you know? Not like a one-bedroom, a little one-room dressing room that, you know, that they could change clothes or whatever, or lie down or, you know. And, but there were a lot of people on the stage. So, you know, sometimes you want to hide. It was real, real dark, soundproof.
That would allow the boys to have fun out there, or, and their guests, and they could play music if they wanted to. They could do whatever they wanted to.
Yeah, and they had a special light for everybody when they were...
Did you notice a difference when you were filming season two? Were people more tired or a different feeling?
You know, for me, no, because every time I saw one of them, they'd have a big smile on their face. They'd have a big hug for me and a good morning kiss, and we started out every day like that. I'd feel, you know, Peter's arms around me, or, you know, just... I just can't even tell you how much love there was on the set. So, and I was not aware of what they were going through or doing on, you know, in the music end of it. I was just not a part of that.
Today, Melanie and I were looking at the movie Head, and we saw you in a scene. You're standing by another beloved monkey character, Captain Crocodile, which is kind of weird when you think about it, that they were kind of taking elements from the show and interspersing them through the movie. And do you have any thoughts on working on the headset?
You know, they were writing it while they were on the monkey set.
Right.
They were writing Head, and Jack and Bob and... You know, I think everyone was involved in that, the writing of it. And
were you paid separately,
you know,
to do...
Why they put Captain Crocodile.
Yeah.
I'd like to know why. Why did you do that?
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
I got to tell you that you guys know more than I do, okay? I must come clean about this.
Listen, this is the first time anyone's ever said that I knew anything at all. So, and if you talk to my wife, she'll tell you I don't know much, so.
Well, you know a lot.
Were you paid separately for being in the movie Head as a background character? Okay.
Of course, yeah.
Did you ever see the movie Head?
No.
It is one of the weirdest things you will ever see. A lot of people... Yeah, a lot of people see it and they think, oh, it's a monkeys movie. I like that TV show. I'll enjoy the movie. It's really different. And I recently got that movie on Blu-ray this last year, and I feel like I saw it for the first time because I had a DVD version that just was not its proper aspect ratio and all that. So it just kind of looks weird. But I recently saw it on Blu-ray, and it's just, it's amazing, but it's also amazingly weird. So, if you ever see it, you have to let us know what you think, okay?
Yeah. Now, there's one photo that's going around of me in like, the I Dream of Jeannie costume in Head.
Wow.
And I don't remember that at all.
Huh.
At all. I didn't remember the pictures of me that are the other pictures in Head. I didn't remember them.
Huh.
So,
well, Valerie,
it's pretty...
There is a quote from Robin Williams, and he says, if you can remember the 60s, you weren't there.
There you go. But, you know, and I think Nikki uses that all the time.
Yeah.
Hey, that's a groovy button. What does it say?
Love is the ultimate trip.
That's a nice thought.
That's a nice button. What does it say?
Save the Texas Plan.
Let's go again.
Hey, what is it? Hey, that's a nice button. What does it say?
Love is the ultimate trip.
Oh, that's a groovy thought.
That's a nice button. What does it say?
Save the Texas Plan. Hold it.
Let's go again.
Hey, That's a groovy button. What does it say?
Love is the ultimate trip.
Oh, that's a nice thought.
That's a groovy button. What does it say?
Save the Texas Prairie Chicken.
Now, you mentioned the young fellow by the name of Mickey Dolenz. I'm going to take you through each one of the boys. I'd like you to share a special moment or something you remember from them. We'll mention each one by name. We'll start with Mickey.
When I was working on the show with the guys, Mickey was an incredible person. His door was always open to everybody. He lived in Laurel Canyon. He had people over all the time. Anyway, I could just go over there and go hang out at Mickey's house. It was a lot of fun. I remember when my father died when we were on the show, and that was a really difficult time. I went to Mickey's house right from the cemetery to Mickey's house, and he opened the door and he looked at me, "Oh my God, who died?" And I said, my dad. And come on in. And he just was so supportive, you know. He was just, he didn't question me. He didn't try to tell me that he's in a better place. He didn't try to, he was just there being supportive, you know.
Wow.
Would you like something to drink? Would you like something to eat? Would you like something, you know, just supportive? Mm-hmm. And I really feel that he's the one that carried me through that pain, you know, that helped me to deal with that, helped me to deal with my father's death.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, Mickey would take us to movies, take a group of us, you know, to movies. Remember, we all went to... the Cinerama Dome, and this was when it was still on Hollywood Boulevard. Not the Cinerama Dome, that's a different Cinerama, it was called, with the different screens, and we all went to see 2001.
Oh, wow.
Space Odyssey. He's a great example of what we all should be. Really, all of the boys are.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to just single, but Mickey is especially... If you've got something and you're doing something wonderful, Mickey is right there to support you through it. You know,
wow.
He's a fantastic father. He has fantastic daughters, creative, kind, wonderful ladies. I hope that, you know, everyone goes and checks out all of their talents, because they're especially talented girls. And he's just wonderful, and not to mention that his wife is a gem. She's a darling, and she's so much like Mickey. She's always very, very supportive and very kind and very loving. What else can I say? I just adore these people. And I was talking to Donna backstage. I don't know how we came about talking about the Monkey Mobile. But we were talking about it, and I said, "Oh, Donna," I said, "it's unbelievable. You know, when they got the Monkey Mobile, when the pilot sold, and they got the Monkey Mobile, and they told them to go out and drive it, get to know each other, and the boys got in the car, and they all came over to my house. They knew where I lived because Peter stayed with my roommate and I after we did the pilot." So they all drove the Monkey Mobile over to my house, and I wasn't home. So that was so sad. Mickey walked up to Donna and I at that moment, and Donna said, "Do you remember driving the Monkey Mobile? Valerie was just telling me about you guys going over with the Monkey Mobile over to her house." And Mickey said, "Yes, I do. You were living in the valley." He even remembered where we lived.
Wow.
Unbelievable, you know.
So what,
50 years ago, yeah.
What was it like having Peter Tork as a roommate?
Oh, God, it was wonderful. Are you kidding? We made him sing for his supper, my roommate and I. See, I had a roommate, and so I called her up, and I said, you know, I said, "Cherie, there's this actor that I worked with, and... you know, he's from Connecticut, and he doesn't really have a place to stay here. And until, you know, we just finished the pilot and, you know, he's going to wait for the pilot to be sold. Is it okay if he comes and stays with us? She's an actress, too, you know, and she said, oh, yeah, sure, we'll give him the downstairs. And I said, okay. You know, so he had the couch and the downstairs, and we made him sing the songs, and he was wonderful. He really did enjoy it, too. Come on, you know. But Peter has just been so dear to me. And to my son, he's good to my son, and he's a wonderful person, and I love him dearly. I hope that they all hear me and they know how much I love them.
They will. Now we'll talk about the wool-hatted Michael Nesmith.
Oh my gosh, Michael. Oh, he is. You know what I like about Michael so much? He is such a gentleman. He is so traditional. You know, he opens the door for ladies. He's just such a gentleman. He's, you know, from a lady's point of view, a lot of men have lost this tradition, and I really feel that it should be there. You know, it's very it's a good way to be.
Uh-huh.
To be. Michael is, he's really, really, really an incredible writer. I think that he's very sensitive,
uh-huh.
More sensitive than most people think, extremely giving. He was the most grown up of all of us because he was already married and had Christian.
Right.
So he was ahead of us in a sense. You know, mm-hmm. More grown up. We were kind of like free and had time to goof around and everything, whereas Michael didn't. He, you know, he had to be a father, he had to be a husband, and he had to do the show, and he an incredible writer. I mean, my goodness, look at Different Drum and, you know, all the hits he was already having. So he's a wonderful person. Mm-hmm. I just love him. I love those guys. What, can you tell?
Yeah, Melanie, would
you tell how much I love them? I want to cry sometimes, but I know that Michael would be very, very upset if I did, because he doesn't like it when people cry. I have a feeling because it'll make him cry. You know, but he's fantastic, and what a talent, incredible man.
I certainly hope that you'd tell us something about your relationship with Davy Jones.
My name's Davy Jones, and I think I love you.
Daisy was always sweet and always kind on the show. Like I said, they all were. Always had that beautiful smile. I can see it right now. A very odd thing happened. I was thinking about him, and I ran across a piece of paper and some other signs that I had. And this piece of paper said February 12th, 2000. And 12, and that was the last time that I saw him. I went to the Marriott Hotel, and we were talking. He was sharing stories with me and signing autographs at the same time. It's really hard for me to talk about this. He was telling me about some demolition that he was doing on his barn.
Mm-hmm.
And he was said that he was taking off the roof, and he said that he went to bed that night, he had chest pains.
Oh my God.
And I said, Davy, you've got to go to the doctor. You've got to get this checked out.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I will. I said, I mean it, Davy. You've got to go do this. And he said, no. He said, sorry. It was just because I was doing the demolition with my arm,
mm-hmm.
and taking off these, I don't know, he was ripping off a roof or something. And he said, that's what it was from. And I said, I don't care. You've still got to go to a doctor. As I was leaving, he ran after me and handed me his CD. We put our arms around each other, and I said, I love you, Davy. And he said, I love you, Valerie.
Oh.
You know what happened next.
Yeah.
That was just a little more than 2 weeks later.
Right. So, it was, it's still very hard to accept that he's gone, but I really feel like he gives me signals, like this piece of paper appearing that had that date on it.
Wow.
You know, out of, you know, why did that piece of paper appear after I just spoke to, was it you, Ken, that I was talking to?
Yeah.
I think it was. I think it was you, and we were talking about him, and I hung up the phone, and then all of a sudden this piece of paper falls out of nowhere, you know, with that date on it, the last time I saw him. There's just all of these signs that he's still around, that he knows that we love him.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that, you know, I believe that with all of my heart, that he is still around, and we just can't see him or put our arms around him and kiss him the way we used to.
Right.
That smile of his every morning on the set, can you imagine?
Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
Every morning on the set.
Yeah.
You know, and he was always the easygoing, great sense of humor. In Beavertown, I found out that he had neighbors, actually. He had one, and it's funny because I couldn't find the fairgrounds. I was driving around like a doodah, and I pulled over to this one house that had a bunch of beautiful flowers in front of it. There was a man in the front yard, and I said, do you know where the fairgrounds is? He was right next door to Davy's house. and so was it like right in front of me? He pointed me in the right direction and everything. He said, yes, I'm here taking care of my 92-year-old mother. He started telling me Davy's stories about how Davy would come down and make sure that she was okay, ask her if she needed anything from the store, you know, because her son didn't live with her. He was just visiting her. Uh-huh. So I got those stories from him. And then I found other neighbors in Beavertown that told me the same stories of how kind he was and how he cared about people. And it's true, you know, he was an example for us of how to be in life.
Mm-hmm.
He was put here for a reason for us, you know, to teach us.
Wow.
And we need to, you know, follow his lead.
Mm-hmm.
I love you, Davy.
I think that all of us love Davy, and it's hard to watch the show at times. It's hard to even hear the music sometimes, and it'll always reverberate with all of us that cared. There are more and more Monkey fans every year, so just think, you know, you're mentioning Antenna TV. Some teenage girl out there is looking up and having a crush on Davy for the first time on Antenna TV.
Yeah.
It's never going to end, those twinkly eyes. So.
Yeah, I think so. Where was I? I was in a diner once, and I overheard a waitress talking about Monkey's show, and my ears perked up, and she said, that's the only show I can let my children watch.
Mm.
And I chimed in, and I said, really? And I said, what do you mean by that? And she said, well, you know, there's so much garbage on TV. She said that I don't let my children watch those shows. And she said, but the Monkees, you know, that's a good... And I said, well, wait a minute. What about the Disney Channel and that? And she said, oh, my God, no. You know, and I said, really? Because I don't, you know, I'm not familiar with that. But she, you know, a good, clean, wholesome show for kids that's not, and those they're not available anymore, you know, and the Monkees is definitely wonderful to show our kids and grandkids and their kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with you. I think it's going to be around a long time.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, we want to thank you for being on the show today. And,
it's my honor and my pleasure.
Well,
I have to thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, no. Seriously, this is quite a thrill for us. We look forward to seeing you at future expos or conventions or wherever the road may lead us all together to one another. Look forward to seeing you again.
take care.
All right, dear.
I thank you again, both of you, for everything, and I'll talk to you soon, I hope.
All right, dear. All right, thank you so much.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We're so glad to have that interview today. We thank you for listening. Now we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to play a clip from another podcast. The podcast in question is The Rewind Show with Jimmy J. He interviewed Peter Tork back in 2007. It's episode 92 if you want to find it on iTunes. We will put links in the show notes. It's definitely worth checking out the whole interview because you'll get to hear some questions for Peter Tork that aren't your standard five questions that you get in every Peter Tork interview. So check it out. In this interview, he talks about the B-Team, and Val Carey's mentioned these same fellows who were the friends of the Monkees who worked on the show and went on tour with them. So Peter Tork refers to them as the B-Team. So check this out.
Peter, this is a very historic moment. You know, this is actually, first of all, welcome to Rewind, and a lot of your fans are here. Can we have a nice round of applause for Peter? Now, Peter, of all the songs the Monkees did, my favorite was Mr. Dabalina, Mr. Bob Dabalina. Do you remember that one?
Of course I do.
How did it go? Is it China Keep a Callin'?
Actually, you know what? It was the B-Team. I have to hand it to the B-Team on this.
You folks remember what we're talking about?
Yes.
It was an album cut, yeah.
Sure.
I love that thing.
The B-Team, these are the guys who Rick Klein and David Pearl and a couple of other guys of Mike's and Mickey's from before the Monkees, and they just sort of joined on as the B-Team. They were the guys, they were our stand-ins when we were doing the TV show. They were the crew on the tour. They were tour techies on the road, bodyguards if we needed them. I mean, they were the guys who were right there, the shadow team. And one or two of those guys came in. One of them had heard Mr. Dabalina, Mr. Bob Dabalina, said over an airport intercom, Mr. Dabalina, Mr. Bob Dabalina, Mr. Dabalina, Mr. Bob Dabalina. And he was gone. And then China Clipper calling Alameda.
China Clipper?
Is that yeah, because okay. that's from, I think the movie was called China Clipper. It was a story of those first flying boats, those great big flying boats. They were fabulous, luxurious things that actually landed on water. Airliners, two double-decker airliners landed on water, and they were used for transoceanic flights. And the movie was called China Clipper. China Clipper calling Alameda. Coming in from Japan, you're calling Alameda, California. That was the control station for the flying clippers. China Clipper calling Alameda. China Clipper calling Alameda. China Clipper calling Alameda. And never mind the furthermore, the plea is self-defense.
What is it?
Never mind the furthermore, the plea is self-defense.
What's that?
You got.
Oh, okay. Where's that from?
Where's it from?
Oklahoma.
From the movie Oklahoma? That's actually in there? Okay, where is, it is of my opinion that the people are intending. Where's that from, you? Okay.
Guess we showed you. So let's try this. Can we try this, all right?
You want to actually divide the gangs up?
Yeah, let's try to do it, okay? Because that'll be fun, and we're live.
Go ahead.
Kind of sort of live. Wait a minute, have you ever done this before?
I'd rather do the monkey walk.
Wait a minute, have you ever done this before?
Yeah, I recorded it. It was on headquarters.
Has it ever been done with an audience trying to do it?
No, now that you mention it, never has been done with an audience trying to do it.
So let's try it, okay? So we're going to start over here, and they're going to be...
Let's see, divide the room into quarters,
okay.
Right?
Okay, yeah.
Saw somebody who's shocked the daylights out of me. Okay, you're here. You guys are the fourth one. You guys are the third one.
The first is what?
Mr. Lena? Dabalina, Mr. Bob Dabalina.
You guys got that? Let's practice. Mr. Dabalina, Mr. Bob Dabalina. Come on, you got to do
Mr. Dabalina, Mr. Bob Dabalina.
Okay.
China Clipper calling Alameda. China Clipper calling Alameda. China Clipper calling Alameda. China Clipper calling Alameda. Never mind the furthermore, the plea is self-defense. Never mind the furthermore, the plea is self-defense. It is of my opinion that the people are intending. It is of my opinion that the people... It is of my opinion that the people are intending.
It is of my opinion that the people are intending. Woohoo! Yeah!
Well, that was worth it.
One of the members of our studio audience asked me if you could recite a track from Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and Jones LTD album. The track they want to hear is Peter Percival Patterson's Pet Pig Porky.
Sure. Wait a minute. Peter Percival Patterson had a pet pig named Porky. This pet pig named Porky loved pie. He loved pizza pie, pumpkin pie, pineapple pie, minced tarts.
Peter Percival Patterson's pork he loved. Pie for breakfast, pie for lunch, pie for dinner, and pie before he went to bed. Peter Percival Patterson's pork he ate so much pie that do you know what he did?
What did he do?
I thought you'd never ask. He popped. Thank you, thank you. Don't forget to tip your bartender and waitress. Try the deal.
Thank you again, man. We really appreciate it.
Okay, and we want to thank Jimmy J and the Rewind podcast for letting us use that. And we really encourage you to check them out. And here's Peter Tork with Ain't Your Fault and Dress Sexy for Me. These were featured on our mini episode, but that one's going to be disappearing soon, so enjoy them here.
Hi. My name is Peter Tork. That's my stage name anyway. It's really Torkelson. Actually, it's really Torkelsteinovich Owitzki, but the parents changed it when they came over. So I shortened it to Tork for a stage name because if you've only got this much space, Tork is this big, but Torkelsteinovich Owitzki is like only this tall. So anyway, I'm here at Wolfgang's Vault, or Wolfgang's Fault. It's Wolfgang's Fault that I'm here. I'm going to do a song. An authentic 1950s Chicago blues that I wrote last year. You paying attention? These are the jokes.
But ain't your fault, babe. Go ahead and do what you gotta do. No, it ain't your fault, babe, that you don't love me like I love you. It ain't your fault, baby, that I'm so blue. Well, I know you don't want to hurt me, and you say it's a crying shame, but you didn't do anything wrong, my baby, and nobody's to blame. No, it ain't your fault, baby, that you don't love me like I love you. It ain't your fault, baby, that I'm so blue. None, I know you don't like it much. You'd even take it on yourself, but you don't do anyone any good putting your own life on the shelf. No, it ain't your fault, baby, that you don't love me like I love you. It ain't your fault, baby, that I'm so blue. No, it ain't your fault, baby. Go ahead and do what you gotta do. No, it ain't your fault, babe, that you don't love me like I love you. It ain't your fault, baby, that I'm so blue. That I'm so blue. That I'm so blue. I'm so blue.
Thank you. I thought we were pretending there was nobody here.
We blew that.
Yeah. Sky high. Here's a song that I want some of you women to pay attention to. The trouble is, you don't all know who you are, but that's okay.
You've been hanging around. You've been acting shy. You've been talking profound. Been batting your eye, but if you want to set my achy soul free, dress sexy for me. Sexy. Dress sexy for me. You look so rough and tough when you wear that sexy stuff. Tight sweaters and skirts, I can't get enough. Cut real low so I can see. Dress sexy for me. Sexy. Dress sexy for me, baby. Sexy. Show me some leg. Make me beg. Show me some thigh. Make me cry. Show me some lace. Ain't no disgrace. Come a little closer, baby, right up in my face. Dress sexy for me. Sexy. Dress sexy for me, baby. Show me some leg. Make me beg. Show me some thigh. Make me cry. Show me some lace. No disgrace. Come a little closer, baby, right up in my face. Dress sexy for me. Dress sexy for me, baby. Please, baby, just sexy. Dress sexy for me, baby. You know how I love that stuff when you do it. Oh, baby.
Okay, well, I guess it's time to wrap it up, so take some time to monkey around.
Isn't that dumb?
And that's our show. Zilch is an online nonprofit monkeys audio fanzine made by fans for fans. Any samples of music or interviews heard remain property of their owners. We are not related to the monkeys or any of their members past or present. We are not affiliated with Rhino or Ray Burr. If you hear anything you like from the band, go on Amazon or iTunes and buy it. If you enjoyed the show, like us on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm your announcer, Chelsea Epstein, saying always take some time to monkey around.